We have been talking about love for the last couple of weeks, and the way we've been talking about it is like this. Love is it's kind of like a motor. It drives us. Whatever that object of our love that we are pursuing, our love drives us onward. Augustine said, love is a force that is compelling all human action. And so we are pursuing the objects of our love, and love is driving us there. And what we're ultimately trying to do is get to that blessed place we call happy, that wonderful state of being, and love is driving us on. The problem is that our love is disordered. It's out of whack. It's not rightly aligned. We pursue things that don't actually satisfy. You see, if you're going to end up in that place called happy, whatever it is your love is driving you to, it first has to be something that you can actually acquire. And once you have it, it has to satisfy, and it can't be taken away from you, and you can't lose it against your will. Well, only one thing in the universe qualifies. It's God. So you got to get your loves in order, and the first thing, it has to be God. Because if you seek God and you seek your happiness in Him, you will never actually be disappointed. But Jesus goes on in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, to tell us what comes next. You get God up in front, out in the middle, and you put all the weight of your love there, but then right after it is your neighbors. You love your neighbor as you love yourself. But as we saw last week, our propensity is to look for loopholes so that we don't actually have to do the things that we know how to do. We ask really well-crafted questions to get ourselves out of it. Well, who is my neighbor? If you find yourself asking that question, watch out. The question itself is wrong. It is, in fact, the problem. Who's your neighbor? Everybody. So who do you have to love? Well, everybody. Always. It's that simple and that difficult. Everybody, always. So you have these two commands and three people to love. Did you catch that? Two commands, three people to love. You got to love God. Got to love neighbor. But you have to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Thought about that? Do you love yourself? Do you get up in the morning and see yourself as a proper object for your love? That's where we're going to be this morning. There's really, I think, two pretty typical responses to this passage. I don't want to say interpretations, but ways that people latch on to this passage and they use it. I think both of them miss the point, and one's a bit of a reaction to the other. The first response is this. It comes from that positive thinking crowd, the self-help gurus. I mean, every year there's hundreds of books published that'll tell you how to be a better you. And they're not even necessarily Christian, but they'll steal something from just about anybody. And this may be the only passage in the Bible that they like, but they hear you gotta love your neighbor the way you love yourself, and they latch onto that and they're like, that's right. You've got to love yourself. In fact, if you're going to love your neighbor, you really have to love yourself well. In fact, probably the best way to love your neighbor is to put yourself first, and to really pour into yourself, and so they recommend all sorts of things like self-love and self-affirmation. You know, pat yourself on the back, tell yourself how good you are, and you need self-acceptance. You need to embrace the beauty of your own brokenness, because that's how you become a more authentic you, right? If you love yourself and accept yourself as you are, you'll have peace, and then you will be free to love your neighbors as they are. You know, you're good with yourself, and you can be good with their self, and it's all fine. But the first thing you have to do is really love and take care of you. It's out there. If you haven't heard it, just get on the internet. It's all over the place. And you can understand how a message like that would appeal to a culture that struggles with being pretty self-centered and self-absorbed, right? Then there's kind of a reaction to that. You probably catch this more in the church. And they hear this kind of self-love talk, and they're like, oh, good grief. That is not what this passage is about, because at the end of the day, nobody really struggles with self-love. That's innate. You already have it. Don't give them any more ammunition to be self-centered and self-absorbed. There's plenty of that. This isn't about loving yourself. You already do that. Don't worry about it. The problem is that we love ourselves too much and we love others not enough. The point of the passage is telling you to love others because we know the real nature of love. Jesus role modeled it. The Bible tells us. No man has greater love than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. The essence of love is self-sacrifice. So don't talk about self-love. It's not really the point. Well, which is it? Is it self-love? Or is it self-sacrifice? How do you know? I think the problem is that both of these perspectives have a nugget of truth. There's enough truth in them to be believed. But at the end of the day, both of them actually miss the heart of the matter. They really do miss the point. I think my problem with that second perspective that you probably find more in the church because it sounds more biblical, and I don't actually think self-love is that self-evident. In fact, I would say that there's lots of people out there that don't love themselves rightly. I read a book recently by a guy named Jordan Peterson. You don't know who he is, get on the internet. Real interesting character. He's a Canadian psychologist, and for a little while he seemed to be like the new intellectual poster boy for conservatives. Really interesting guy, not a Christian, but a really interesting thinker. And he wrote this book, 12 Rules for Living, An Antidote to Chaos. And one of his rules for people to live a good life is this: take care of yourself like somebody you are responsible for. Take care of yourself like somebody you are responsible for. And his whole premise is that we actually do a better job of taking care of other people than ourselves. In fact, he goes on to argue and cite some research to suggest that people actually take care of their pets better than they take care of themselves. That most people are actually more likely to get their dog or cat the medical treatment that they need and not themselves. The cat will go to the vet, but they're not going to the doctor, even when they need it for themselves. There's a whole body of research to suggest that this is actually true. Even if a person does go to the doctor, go to the doctor's office, check in, get a diagnosis, get a prescription. Of people who go to the doctor and get a prescription, 20 to 30% of all prescriptions written will never actually be filled. 20 to 30% of people just won't. They've already gone to the doctor, but they won't go pick up the medicine that they need. 50% of medication dispensed for chronic disease will never be taken. People with chronic diseases who actually go pick up the medicine, half of them, after having picked it up, won't take it. Of those who do fill their prescriptions and take it, typically, this is just an average, they only take 50% of the dosage. So the minority of people that actually go and get the medicine that they need and start taking it, they only take half of what they need. 41% of all heart attack patients will not take their blood pressure medication. 41%. You had a heart attack, for goodness sake, just take the pill. Won't take their blood pressure medication. This is the scary one. One third of all kidney transplant patients will not take their anti-rejection medicine. That's frightening, isn't it? You've been on a list to get an organ that'll save your life. You've spent how much money on this operation, and then once you have the new organ that's going to keep you alive, you just simply don't take the medicine that keeps your body from rejecting the organ that's not actually yours. One third. It seems like we live in a day and an age where the only prescription medication that people want to consistently take is not the stuff that helps them, but the opioid painkillers. And then there's all sorts of other people. They're self-medicating. Drugs, alcohol, other forms of substance abuse. I don't think self-love is that self-evident. There are millions of Americans who will experience death by lifestyle. The reason that they die is because of the life they have chosen to live. They go to the doctor. The doctor says, look, you've got to change your diet. What you're eating is actually going to kill you. Just change what you eat and you can live a long, healthy life. And they say, no. Go to the doctor. You got to exercise. Just get up off the couch and walk around a little bit. You've got to exercise or your lifestyle is going to kill you. No. How are there any Americans left who don't know that smoking will kill you? I mean, seriously, it's on the carton, it's on the TV, there's like big signs. How do we know? It's going to kill you and you're going to die a terrible death and they won't stop. How many people do we know like this? The sort of person that, like, if you feel really bad for them and you give them $2, they find a way to misspend three. They don't get ahead. They don't profit. And it's like they can't help themselves. Don't we know people like that? People that they consistently make lifestyle decisions that harm themselves just over and over and over again. And you're like, you know it's dumb. I know it's dumb. Why are you doing it? And so we live with this like contradiction between what we know is innate, this desire for self-preservation, this desire for life, and the obvious ways that we're just not doing it. That we're not actually in action loving ourselves. But this is actually not a new thing. Over 1,000 years ago, Augustine recognized this. This is what he had to say about it. He who knows how to love himself loves God. That's an interesting thought. He who knows how to love himself loves God, but he who does not love God, even if he does love himself, a thing implanted in him by nature, yet is not unsuitably said to hate himself. Inasmuch as he does that which is averse and harmful to himself and assails himself as though he were his own enemy. And this is no doubt a terrible delusion that whereas all wish and will to profit themselves, many do nothing but that which is most pernicious and harmful to themselves. We will our own profit and then we go out and do what is harmful. But I think for many of us, the issue actually runs a little bit deeper than that, doesn't it? Because it's not just this contradiction between self-love and the way we act towards ourselves. It's deeper inside of us, isn't it? It's a contradiction between self-love and how we actually feel about ourselves. I mean, can we be honest? I mean, a lot of us in this room, we're not going to raise hands or anything, but if we had to be honest, we would not describe the way we feel about ourselves as love. Oh, we feel lots of stuff, don't we? Disappointment. Insecurity. Sense of insufficiency. Inadequacy. Shame. Brené Brown gives a really interesting definition of shame. Shame is the intense, painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. You think that you are so flawed and broken, you're not actually worthy of other people's acceptance and belonging or that connection that we need so desperately. Shame. And here's the thing. I don't think the solution to the way we feel about ourselves is more me. More self-love, more self-acceptance. Here's the truth of it, right? You can be completely self-loathing and completely self-deprecating and still be completely self-centered and self-absorbed. All at the same time that on the view screen of your life, it's all you, and the whole time you're sitting there looking, you hate everything that you see. That's a bad place to be. And I don't think it's so simple as just acting lovingly It's not like we can just jettison how we feel about ourselves as if it doesn't matter. And say, well, you just need to act loving. You may feel terrible, but in action, do what is loving for others. Because I think it misunderstands what the passage is really getting at. I realized something this week, that I've been reading this passage wrong for a very, very long time. Now, today, I want all of you to go home with a sense that you really got your money's worth. You know, I want you to feel like our pastor did his homework this week. So for the next 2 minutes, we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into the text. If it gets a little heady, I promise we'll come back up, okay? I've been reading this wrong. The passage says, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. And I've heard that my whole life, and it's called a command, is it not? It is. It's called a command, so my assumption is that the verb tense there is an imperative. An imperative is the verb tense where we give a command. So if I say to my son, get in bed, that's an imperative. If 5 minutes later, in exasperation, I say, get back in bed, still an imperative, right? I'm giving my son a command on the authority of my fatherhood. I'm telling him what to do. So I just assume that's what's going on here. Jesus is saying, I'm Jesus. Love your neighbor the way you love yourself. Imperative. It's not an imperative. It's a future indicative. What's an indicative? It's how it sounds. It indicates what is the case. It just tells you how things are, right? But it's a future indicative. So it's telling you how things are going to be in the future. Now, this is where Greek gets a little bit complicated. A future indicative can be used in an imperative sense. I know. A future indicative can be used in an imperative sense. Are we okay? Are we still good? Okay. You guys are going to be Greek experts when we're done. It's great. You're getting your money's worth. Future indicative in the imperative sense. Let me translate that into English. If I tell my son, get in bed, that's an imperative. If he begins to argue with me, and I look at him, I say, boy, you will be in that bed. Future indicative. And you can hear how it carries that sense of the imperative, right? The command's implied, is it not? But it's telling my boy what is inevitably going to be the case. You will be in that bed. And when I understood this, it changed the way that I heard the passage. See, before I was hearing Jesus say, because I am Jesus, you must do this. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Or it is citing the Old Testament. So because the Bible says so, you must love your neighbor as you love yourself. I'm hearing it different now. Hearing it different. It's not like you must. You will love your neighbor the way that you love yourself. Because that's just how it works. In fact, it can't be otherwise. And so I began to wonder if maybe in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, as it's pointing back to the Old Testament, it's pointing back to a command that's built on this very ancient deep wisdom about what it means to be human and how our humanity works. Maybe it just understands that there is a deep and reciprocal connectedness between all persons. And it works something like this. The way I feel about and love myself has a direct impact on the way that I feel about you and the way I love you, and vice versa. You will love your neighbor with whatever love you do or do not have for yourself. That's just how the world spins. Let me paint a picture for you. I think all of us want esteem, do we not? Yeah. We want to be esteemed. We want to know that we are valuable, that our lives matter for something, that we have worth. We want healthy self-esteem. But here's where we tend to get this wrong. We begin to imagine that self-esteem arises primarily out of the self. And it does not. Self-esteem, in fact, comes from outside of us. In fact, so many of the conclusions we have about ourselves are actually reflections of what other people have given us. The way we conceive of ourselves and we put together our identity, it's not just what I came up with on my own. No, it's the byproduct of a profoundly complex web of relationships and social interactions, from your parents to your peers, to your coaches, to your teachers, to your neighbors, the people you looked up to and the people you despised and the people who encouraged you and the people who tore you down. And it all comes together kind of piecemeal to tell you a little bit about who you are and what you're worth. The problem is, if that's true, if our conclusions about ourselves are in fact reflections of what other people handed us, that's a bit problematic because, if we're honest, usually we don't hand each other the best stuff. What we tend to be passing around is our brokenness. And we do this in all sorts of really complicated ways. One way we do this, it's called transference. That's what psychologists call it. It's where I take feelings or emotions and I transfer them from one person to another. All of this, by the way, unconsciously. I'm not actually aware that I'm doing it. One writer painted this picture. A father who grew up feeling as if he could never really establish himself in comparison to his peers who got ahead rapidly, while he stayed at home and got drunk, might quite easily tell his son that you are going to amount to a big, fat nothing. This is clearly a projection, for the father is the one who feels like a nothing, but he cannot allow himself to really sit with it, receive, and do something about that feeling, so he just hands it over to his son. The son, having heard this several times from a father he desperately loves and wants terribly to please, takes this projection on as an identity and begins to act on it as if it fully describes him. And so the baton of brokenness is passed from one generation to the next and from one person to another. Transference is a defense mechanism. It's what we do with all the feelings and emotions and ideas that we just don't want to deal with and we can't process because it's too painful. And so we take them out of the conscious mind and we stick it down in the subconscious. It's what we mean when we say, oh, I forgave and forgot. You didn't forget. That junk is still there. And the problem is it still stinks. Now it's just the problem of your subconscious. And your subconscious has got to do something with it. And so it starts handing it out. How shame works. Remember Brown's definition, the intense painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed, deeply flawed, and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. Nobody wants to deal with that feeling. Mm-mm. So we repress it. We push it deep down inside of ourselves and act as if it's not there. But the problem is, the way we love ourselves is inevitably the way that we love others. Have you had a parent, a boss, friend, relative that you could not please? It didn't matter what you did. You were doing good work. I mean, solid work. And it was never good enough. It didn't matter how hard you tried, how well you performed. It was never good enough. It was always a word of criticism. It was always a word of how it could be done just a little bit better. But never an attaboy. Never a good job. And you tried so hard to please them, not knowing that you never could, because they were never going to be pleased with themselves. It wasn't you, it was them. They had the overwhelming sense of inadequacy on the inside. They're the ones who felt really, really bad about themselves. And so they had to tear down everybody else's work around them because it threatened them. That feeling of inadequacy that they had, they didn't want to confront it, so they buried it down, but then they began handing it out in the form of criticism. And now you begin to think that you're the problem. Now you begin to think that maybe you're inadequate. Maybe you begin to think that your work is never going to be good enough because that's all you've ever heard from somebody else who is broken. The way you love yourself is the way you will love your neighbor. We just pass it around. Is this resonating with anybody, or am I just talking about my own problems up here? This is me. This is me. I was really good in school. I got really good grades. I got the good scholarships. And I didn't have any fun. Because I thought I had to prove myself. I thought I had to demonstrate my self-worth to people. Oh, and it doesn't work. Doesn't work. So, man alive, how do we get out of this cycle? How do we find freedom from passing on our brokenness to other people? There's a second half to Augustine's quote. I didn't read it to you. I'm going to read it to you now. He hits the nail on the head. When the mind loves God, and by consequence remembers and understands Him, then, it is rightly enjoined also to love its neighbor as itself. Why? For it has now come to love itself rightly and not perversely when it loves God, by partaking of whom that image not only exists, that's the image of God in us, but it is also renewed so as no longer to be old and restored as to be no longer broken and made holy, so as to be no longer unhappy. That's it. Notice where Augustine begins. He goes actually back to the greatest commandment. He says, you've got to get God in the center of things. You have to love God. It all begins with loving God rightly, as best as we can. You've got to love God rightly, because when God gets to the center of your life, then you are in a position to understand and remember Him. And you might say, well, what in the world does understanding and remembering have to do with it? Man, it is everything. You will not know how to rightly love yourself until you know God and the love He has for you. That is understanding. Until you get there, you'll love yourself in all the wrong ways. You won't love yourself enough. You'll hate yourself. You'll feel disappointed in yourself, or you'll be selfish and self-centered or absorbed, or worse, both. But when you understand the love that God has for you, then you will know in your bones how to love yourself. When you get that, then you're ready to begin living in it. You have to find a way to live in the reality of God's love for you. That's remembering. And this might be the hardest part. Because those of us who've grown up with shame or whatever name we want to give it, the baggage that we're carrying around, the brokenness we bury down, it is hard to remember how God loves. It is actually hard to remember who He is. And I've grown up in the church, and I still struggle with this. Because the minute I screw up again, the minute I sin and do that same old thing I said I wasn't going to do again, all the voices of shame and all the stories I've rehearsed in my mind over and over and over, they come back. You're a failure. You'll never do any better. Why are you even trying? And it just gets louder and louder. And because I have an ear so attuned to those voices, I forget who God is and I forget about His love. I take all those feelings and I project them on Him. If I feel this way about me, surely God, who's perfect, must feel really terrible about me. But it's not true. I forget that God's love is perfect. It's never less. It's the love that said, you are worth my Son dying for. He's seen my life beginning to end and all the failures, and He still loves me deeply and passionately, but I forget it. Oh, I forget it. We've got to find a way to remember who He is and how he loves. Because when you know how he loves you, you will know how to love yourself. And it'll keep you right on the center of the road. You won't go off in either ditch. And you'll find that right balance between self-love and self-sacrifice. Because the love that God has is self-sacrificing. That's the good news of Jesus Christ. And it'll be his love that you have for yourself. And when you get to that sweet spot, you can love all your neighbors the way they need to be. And you're not passing out your junk anymore. You're passing out the love of God, and that heals. It takes what is old and makes it new. It takes what is broken and makes it right. Oh, and it makes it holy. And because you're holy, you will be happy. But man, you got to know the love of God. I've been on this journey of healing some time now, and I haven't arrived. I still hear the old voices from time to time. Maybe you do too. So I want to give you something this morning that I hope can be a home for you. Something when those voices come around and tell you what you think you know about yourself, a solid place you can come back to and know that those voices don't know near as much what they think they know. I want to give you a story this morning. I'm going to invite the worship team up, and we're going to close this way. Pastors don't get up here and pound the pulpit and tell you to read your Bible because it's a good way to prove that you're a good Christian, or if you can read so many verses, that will make you better. That's a shame attitude. That's all the wrong reasons. I encourage you to read Scripture because they are words of life, if you'll hear them. If you'll hear them. This is a story Jesus told. There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to the father, "Father, give me my share of the property that is coming to me." Let me translate that Greek for you. He said, "I can't really wait for you to die. Not really interested in you, but in what you have that I can get." And the father divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in the country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him out into the field to feed pigs. And as he was looking to be, and he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, but no one gave him anything. Was in that place he came to himself. He said, "How many of my father's hired servants have had more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of the hired servants.'" He arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. He wasn't angry. He wasn't disappointed. He felt compassion. And he ran, and he embraced him, and he kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm not worthy to be called your son." But before he even could finish what he had to say, the father said to the servant, "Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet. And bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate, for my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. I don't know what your life journey is telling you about the love of God today. That's true. It's true for me. It's true for you. God loves you. He's not mad. He wants to wrap you up and give you a kiss. Have a party. That's a good ending, isn't it? That's love, God, church.